The Indian sat down beside him, looking at him curiously. "Christ," William said, "you aren't an Indian." That certainly wasn't an Algonquian face. Seen clearly now, the man was much younger than he'd thought, perhaps only a little older than himself, and plainly white, though his skin was sun-browned, and he bore facial tattoos, a double line of dots that looped across his cheekbones. He was dressed in leather shirt and leggings, and wore a most incongruous red and black Scotsman's plaid over one shoulder.
"Aye, I am," the man said dryly.
He raised his chin, indicating the direction taken by the departing Indians.
"Where did you meet with that lot?"
"By the lake. They asked for tobacco, and I gave it to them. But then they chased me. I don't know why." The man shrugged.
"They thought to take you west and sell you as a slave in the Shawnee lands."
He smiled briefly.
"They offered me half your price."
William took a deep breath.
"I thank you, then. That is, I suppose you haven't any intention of doing the same thing."
The man didn't laugh aloud, but gave off a distinct sense of amusement.
"No, I'm no going west."
William began to feel a little easier, though the heat of his endeavours was beginning to give way to chills again. He wrapped his arms about his knees. His right arm was beginning to hurt again.
"You don't... Do you suppose they might come back?"
"No," the man said, casually indifferent. "I told them to be gone."
William stared at him.
"And why do you think they'll do as you say?"
"Because they're Mingo," the man replied patiently. "And I'm Kayenkahaka, a Mohawk. They're afraid of me."
William gave him a narrow look, but the man wasn't practicing upon him. He was nearly as tall as William himself, but thin as a coach whip, his dark brown hair slicked back with bear grease. He looked competent, but not a person to inspire fear. The man was studying him with an interest equal to his own. William coughed and cleared his throat, then extended a hand.
"Your servant, sir. I'm William Ransom."
"Oh, I ken you well enough," the man said,
a rather odd note in his voice. He put out his own hand and shook William's firmly.
"Ian Murray, we've met."
His eyes travelled over William's torn, dishevelled clothes, his scratched, sweating face, and his mud-caked boots.
"You look a bit better than the last time I saw you, but not much."
Murray lifted the camp kettle off the fire and set it on the ground. He laid the knife in the embers for a moment, then dipped the hot blade into the frying pan, now filled with water. The hot metal hissed and gave off clouds of steam.
"Ready?" he said.
"Yes."
William knelt down by a big poplar log and laid his injured arm flat on the wood. It was visibly swollen, the bulge of a large remnant splinter dark under his skin. The skin around it stretched and transparent with pus, painfully inflamed. The Mohawk, he couldn't yet think of him as anything else despite the name and accent, glanced at him across the log, eyebrows raised quizzically.
"Was that you I heard, screaming earlier?"
He took hold of William's wrist.
"I shouted, yes," William said stiffly. "A snake struck at me."
"Oh."
Murray's mouth twitched a little.
"You scream like a lassie," he said, eyes returning to his work.
The knife pressed down. William made a deeply visceral noise.
"Aye, better," said Murray.
He smiled briefly as though to himself, and with a firm grip on William's wrist, sliced cleanly through the skin beside the splinter, laying it open for 6 inches or so. Turning back the skin with the point of the knife, he flicked out the large splinter, then picked delicately at the smaller slivers the cypress shard had left behind. Having removed as much as he could, he then wrapped a fold of his ragged plaid round the handle of the camp kettle, picked it up, and poured the steaming water into the open wound. William made a much more visceral sound,
this one accompanied by words. Murray shook his head and clicked his tongue in reproof.
Aye, well, I suppose I'll have to keep you from dying, because if you do die, you're bound to go to hell using language like that.
I don't propose to die, William said shortly.
He was breathing hard and mopped his brow with his free arm. He lifted the other gingerly and shook blood-tinged water from his fingertips, though the resulting sensation made him light-headed. He sat down on the log rather suddenly.
Put your head between your knees if you're giddy, Murray suggested.
I am not giddy.
There was no response to this save the sound of chewing. While waiting for the kettle to boil, Murray had waded into the water and pulled several handsful of some strong-smelling herb that grew on the verge. He was in process now of chewing the leaves, spitting the resultant green wads into a square of cloth. Extracting a rather shriveled onion from the haversack he carried, he cut a generous slice from this and eyed it critically, but seemed to think it would pass without mastication. He added it to his packet, folding the cloth neatly over the contents. This he placed over the wound and wrapped it in place with strips of cloth torn from William's shirt tail. Murray glanced up at him thoughtfully.
I suppose you're very stubborn.
William stared at the Scot, put out at this remark, though in fact he had been told repeatedly by friends, relatives, and military superiors that his intransigence would one day kill him.
Surely it didn't show on his face. What the devil do you mean by that?
It wasn't meant as an insult,
Murray said mildly, and bent to tighten the knot of the impromptu bandage with his teeth. He turned away and spat out a few threads.
I hope you are, because it'll be a good distance to find your help, and if you're sufficiently stubborn as not to die on me, that would be good, I think. I said I don't propose to die, William assured him. And I don't need help. Where are we anywhere near Dismal Town?
Murray pursed his lips.
No, he said, and raised one brow. Were you bound there?
William considered for an instant, but nodded.
No harm in telling in that, surely.
Murray raised an eyebrow.
Why?
I have business with some gentlemen there.
As he said this, William's heart gave a lurch.
Christ, the book!
He'd been so confounded by his various trials and adventures that the true importance of his loss hadn't even struck him. Beyond its general entertainment value and its usefulness as palimpsests for his own meditations, the book was vital to his mission. It contained several carefully marked passages whose code gave him the names and locations of those men he was to visit. And, more importantly, what he was to tell them. He could recall a good many of the names, he thought, but for the rest. His dismay was so great that it overshadowed the throbbing in his arm, and he stood up abruptly, seized by the urge to rush back into the Great Dismal and begin combing it inch by inch until he should recover the book.
Are you all right, man?
Murray had risen too, and was looking at him with a combination of curiosity and concern.
I thought of something, that's all. Well, think about it sitting down, eh? You're about to fall into the fire.
In fact, William's vision had gone bright, and pulsating dots of dark and light obscured most of Murray's face, though the look of alarm was still visible.
I will.
He sat down even more abruptly than he'd risen, a heavy cold sweat sudden on his face. A hand on his good arm urged him to lie down, and he did, feeling dimly that it was preferable to fainting. Murray made a Scottish noise of consternation and muttered something incomprehensible. William could feel the other man hovering over him, uncertain.
I'm fine, he said, without opening his eyes. I just need to rest a bit.
William couldn't tell whether this particular noise was meant as acceptance or dismay, but Murray went away, coming back a moment later with a blanket with which he covered William without comment. William made a feeble gesture of thanks unable to speak as his teeth had begun to chatter with a sudden chill. His limbs had been aching for some time, but he had ignored it in the need to push on. Now the burden of it fell full on him, a bone-deep ache that made him want to moan aloud. To keep from it, he waited until the chill relaxed enough to let him speak, then called to Murray.
"You are familiar with Dismal Town yourself, sir? You've been there?"
"Now and again, aye."
He could see Murray, a dark silhouette crouched by the fire, and hear the chink of metal on stone.
"It's very aptly named."
"Ah," William said weakly. "I dare say. And have you met a Mr. Washington by chance?"
5 or 6 of them. The General's got a good many cousins, aye?"
"The General Washington? You've heard of him, maybe?"
There was a distinct hint of amusement in the Scottish Mohawk's voice.
"I have, yes, but surely that..."
This made no sense. His voice trailed off, and he rallied, forcing his drifting thoughts back into coherence.
"It is Mr. Henry Washington. He is kin to the General, too."
"So far as I can, anyone named Washington within 300 miles is kin to the General."
Murray stooped to his bag, coming out with a large furry mass, a long naked tail dangling from it.
"Why?"
Nothing.
The chill had eased, and he drew a grateful breath, the knotted muscles of his belly relaxing. But the faint threads of weariness were making themselves felt through puzzlement and the gathering fog of fever.
"Someone told me that Mr. Henry Washington was a prominent loyalist."
Murray turned toward him in astonishment.
"Who in bride's name would tell you that?"
"Plainly someone grossly mistaken."
William pressed the heels of his hands against his eyes. His wounded arm hurt.
"What is that thing?"
"Possum?"
"Muskrat. Vinifash. It's fresh. I killed it just before I met you."
"Oh. Good."
He felt obscurely comforted and couldn't think why.
"Not the muskrat. He'd eaten muskrat often enough and found it tasty, though the fever had stolen his appetite.
He felt weak with hunger but had no desire to eat."
"Oh.
No, it was the dinafash, spoken with just that kindly, matter-of-fact intonation. Mac, the groom, had used to say that to him, often, whether the trouble was being thrown from his pony or not being allowed to ride into the town with his grandfather.
"Dinafash, it will be all right."
The ripping sound of skin parting from the underlying muscle made him momentarily dizzy, and he closed his eyes.
"You've got a red beard."
Murray's voice came to him, filled with surprise.
"You've only just now noticed that?" William said crossly, and opened his eyes.
The colour of his beard was an embarrassment to him, while the hair on his head, chest and limbs was a decent sort of dark chestnut. That on his chin and privates was an unexpectedly vivid shade that mortified him. He shaved fastidiously, even on shipboard or on the road, but his razor, of course, had departed with the horse.
"Well, I," Murray said mildly, "I expect I was distracted earlier."
He fell silent, concentrating on his work, and William tried to relax his mind, hoping to sleep for a time. He was tired enough. Repeated images of the swamp played themselves out before his closed eyes, though, wearying him with visions that he could neither ignore nor dismiss. Roots like the loops of snares, mud, rank brown dollops of cold pig shit, the turds uneasily human-like, churned dead leaves. Dead leaves floating on water like brown glass, reflection shattering around his shins. Words in the water, the pages of his book, faint, mocking as they sank away. Looking up, the sky as vertiginous as the lake, feeling that he might fall up as easily as down and drown in the water-clogged air, drowning in his sweat.
A young woman licked the sweat from his cheek, tickling, her body heavy, hot and clawing, so that he turned and twisted but couldn't escape her oppressive attentions. Sweat collecting behind his ears, thick and greasy in his hair, growing like fat slow pearls in the stubble of his vulgar beard. Chilling on his skin, his clothes a dripping shroud. The woman was still there, dead now. Dead weight on his chest, pinning him to the icy ground. Fog and the creeping cold. White fingers prying into his eyes, his ears. He must keep his mouth shut or it would reach inside him. All white. He curled into a ball, shaking. William did at last fall deeper into a fitful sleep, from which he roused some time later to the rich smell of roasted muskrat, and found the enormous dog lying pressed against him, snoring. "Jesus," he said, with disconcerting recollections of the young woman in his dreams. He pushed feebly at the dog. "Where did that come from?"
"That's Rollo," Murray said reprovingly. "I made him lie with you for a bit of heat. You've got a shaking ague if you hadn't noticed."
"I had noticed that, yes."
William struggled upright and made himself eat, but was happy to lie down again, at a safe distance from the dog, who was now lying on his back, paws drooping, looking like nothing so much as a gigantic, hairy, dead insect. William passed a hand downward over his clammy face, trying to remove that disturbing image from his mind before it made its way into his fever dreams. Night had come well on, and the sky opened overhead, clear and empty and vast, moonless but brilliant with distant stars. He thought of his father's father, long dead before his own birth, but a noted amateur astronomer. His father had often taken him, and sometimes his mother, to lie on the lawns at Hellwater, to look up at the stars and name the constellations. It was a cold sight, that blue-black emptiness, and made his fevered blood tremble. But the stars were a comfort nonetheless. Murray was looking upward too, a look of distance on his tattooed face. William lay back, half propped against the log, trying to think. What was he to do next? He was still trying to absorb the news at Henry Washington, and thus, presumably, the rest of his dismal town contacts were rebels. Was this odd Scottish Mohawk right in what he'd said? Or did he seek to mislead him for some purpose of his own? What would that be, though? Murray could have no notion who William was, beyond his name and his father's name. And Lord John had been a private citizen when they had met years before on Fraser's Ridge. Murray couldn't tell, surely, that William was a soldier, let alone an intelligencer, and couldn't possibly know his mission. And if he did not wish to mislead him, and was correct in what he said... William swallowed, his mouth sticky and dry. Then he had had a narrow escape. What might have happened had he walked into a nest of rebels in such a remote place as Dismal Town and blithely revealed himself and his purpose? "They'd hang you from the nearest tree," his brain said coldly, "and toss your body into the swamp. What else?" Which led to an even more uncomfortable thought. How could Captain Richardson have been so mistaken in his information? He shook his head violently, trying to shake his thoughts into order, but the only result was to make him dizzy again. Murray's attention had been attracted by the motion, though. He looked in William's direction, and William spoke on impulse. "You are a Mohawk," you said.
"I am."
Seeing that tattooed face, the eyes dark in their sockets, William didn't doubt it. "How did that come to be?" he asked hurriedly, lest Murray think he was casting aspersions on the other's truthfulness. Murray hesitated visibly, but did answer.
"I married a woman of the Cayenne Kahaka. I was adopted into the wolf clan of the people of Snake Town."
"Ah, your
wife is...
I am no longer wed.
It wasn't said with any tone of hostility, but with a sort of bleak finality that put paid to any further conversation.
I'm sorry, William said formally, and fell silent.
The chills were coming back, and despite his reluctance, he slid down, drawing the blanket up around his ears, and huddled against the dog, who sighed deeply and released a burst of flatulence, but didn't stir. When the ague finally eased again, he lapsed back into dreams, these now violent and dreadful. His mind had taken hold somehow of Indians, and he was pursued by savages who turned into snakes, snakes who became tree roots that writhed through the crevices of his brain, bursting his skull, liberating further nests of snakes who coiled themselves into nooses. He woke again, drenched in sweat and aching to the bones. He tried to rise, but found his arms wouldn't support him. Someone knelt by him.
It was the Scot. The Mohawk. Murray.
He located the name with something like relief, and with even more relief realized that Murray was holding a canteen to his lips. It was water from the lake. He recognized its odd, fresh-tasting bitterness, and drank thirstily.
Thank you,
he said hoarsely, and gave back the empty canteen. The water had given him strength enough to sit up. His head still swam with fever, but the dreams had retreated, at least for the moment. He imagined that they lurked just beyond the small ring of light cast by the fire, waiting, and determined that he wouldn't sleep again. Not at once. The pain in his arm was worse, a hot, stretched feeling and a throbbing that ran from fingertips to the middle of his upper arm. Anxious to keep both the pain and the night at bay, he had another try at conversation.
I have heard that the Mohawk think it unmanly to show fear, that if captured and tortured by an enemy, they will not show any sign of distress. Is that true?
You try not to be in that position, Murray said, very dry. Should it happen, though, you must show your courage, that's all. You sing your death song and hope to die well.
Is it different for a British soldier, then?
You don't want to die as a coward, do you?
William watched the flickering patterns behind his closed eyelids, hot and ever-changing, shifting with the fire.
No, he admitted. And it's not so different, the hoping to die well if you have to, I mean. But it's more likely to be a matter of just being shot or knocked on the head, isn't it, if you're a soldier, rather than being tortured to death by inches. Save you run afoul of a savage, I suppose.
What? Have you ever seen someone die like that?
He asked curiously, opening his eyes. Murray reached out one long arm to turn the spit, not answering at once. The firelight showed his face, unreadable.
I have,
he said quietly at last.
What did they do to him?
He wasn't sure why he'd asked, perhaps only for distraction from the throbbing in his arm.
You dinna want to know.
This was said very definitely. Murray was not by any means teasing him into further inquiry. Nonetheless, it had the same effect. William's vague interest sharpened at once.
Yes, I do.
Murray's lips tightened, but William knew a few things about extracting information by this time and was wise enough to preserve silence, merely keeping his eyes fixed on the other man.
Skinned him, Murray said at last,
and poked at the fire with a stick.
One of them, in bitty pieces. Thrust burning slivers of pitch pine into the raw places. Cut away his privates, then built up the fire about his feet to burn him before he could die of the shock. It took some time. I dare say.
William tried to conjure a picture of the proceedings and succeeded much too well, turning away his eyes from the blackened muskrat carcass stripped to bones.
He shut his eyes. His arm continued to throb with each beat of his heart, and he tried not to imagine the sensation of burning slivers being forced into his flesh. Murray was silent. William couldn't even hear his breathing. But he knew, as surely as if he were inside the other's head, that he too was imagining the scene. Though, in his case, imagination wasn't necessary. He would be reliving it. William shifted a little, sending a hot blaze of pain through his arm, and clenched his teeth not to make any noise. Do the men... Did you, I should say, think how you would do yourself, he asked quietly, if you could stand it?
Every man thinks that.
Murray got up abruptly and went to the far edge of the clearing. William heard him make water, but it was some minutes longer before he came back. The dog wakened suddenly, head lifting, and wagged its huge tail slowly to and fro at sight of its master. Murray laughed softly and said something in an odd tongue. Mohawk, Erse, to the dog, then bent and ripped a haunch from the muskrat's remains, tossing it to the beast. The animal rose like lightning, its teeth snapping shut on the carcass, then trotted happily to the far side of the fire and lay down, licking its prize. Bereft of his bed companion, William lay down gingerly, head pillowed on his good arm, and watched as Murray cleaned his knife, scrubbing blood and grease from it with handfuls of grass.
You said you sing your death song. What sort of song is that?
Murray looked nonplussed at that.
I mean, William fumbled for clearer meaning. What sort of thing would one say in a death song? Oh.
The Scotsman looked down at his hands, the long knobbed fingers rubbing slowly down the length of the blade.
I've only heard the one, mind. The other two I saw die that way. They were white men and didn't have death songs as such. The Indian, he was an Onondaga. Well, there was a good deal in the beginning about who he was. A warrior of what people, I mean, and his clan, his family. Then quite a bit about how much he despised, the folk who were about to kill him.
Murray cleared his throat.
A bit about what he'd done, his victories, valiant warriors he'd killed, and how they'd welcome him in death. Then, how he proposed to cross the...
He groped for a word. The way between here and what lies after death.
The divide, I suppose you'd say, though the word means something more like a chasm.
He was quiet for a moment, but not as though he had finished. More as though trying to recall something exactly. He straightened himself suddenly, took a deep breath, and with his eyes closed, began to recite something in what William supposed to be the Mohawk tongue. It was fascinating. A tattoo of N's and R's and T's, steady as a drumbeat.
Then there was a bit where he went on about the nasty creatures he'd encountered on his way to paradise, Murray said, breaking off abruptly. Things like flying heads with teeth.
Ew, said William.
And Murray laughed, taken by surprise.
Aye, I wouldn't have liked to see one myself.
William considered this for a moment.
Do you compose your own death song ahead of time? In case of need, I mean. Or just trust to the, inspiration of the moment?
Murray looked a little taken aback by that. He blinked and looked aside.
It's no usually talked about, Ken.
But I did have a friend or two who told me a bit about what they'd thought of, should there ever be a need.
William turned on his back, looking up at the stars.
Do you sing a death song only if you're being tortured to death? What if you're only ill, but think you might die?
Murray stopped what he was doing and peered toward him, suspicious.
You're no dying, are you?
No,
Just wondering, William assured him. He didn't think he was dying.
Mm-hmm, the Scot said dubiously.
Aye, well. No, you sing your death song if you're sure you're about to die. It doesn't matter why.
The more credit to you, though, William suggested, if you do it whilst having burning splinters stuck into you.
The Scot laughed out loud and suddenly looked much less like an Indian. He rubbed his knuckles across his mouth.
To be honest, the Onondaga,
I didn't think he did it so very well, Murray blurted.
It doesn't seem right to criticise, though. I mean, I kinda say I'd do better, in the circumstances.
William laughed too, but both men fell silent then. William supposed that Murray was, as he was, imagining himself in such a case, tied to a stake, about to suffer appalling torture. He gazed up into the void above, tentatively composing a few lines.
I am William Clarence Henry George Ransom, Earl of... No, he'd never liked his string of names.
I am William, he thought muzzily. William James.
James was his secret name. He hadn't thought of it in years.
Better than Clarence, though.
I am William.
What else was there to say?
Not much as yet. No, he'd better not die, not until he'd done something worth a proper death song.
Murray was silent, the fire reflected in his sombre eyes. Watching him, William thought the Scottish Mohawk had had his own death song ready for some time. Shortly, he fell asleep to the crackle of fire and the quiet crunching of bones. Burning, but brave. He was wandering through a haze of tortured dreams involving being chased by black serpents across an endless wobbling bridge over a bottomless chasm. Flying yellow heads with rainbow eyes attacked him in swarms, their tiny teeth sharp as a mouse's, piercing his flesh. He waved an arm to beat them off, and the pain that shot through the arm at the motion roused him. It was still dark, though the cool, live feel of the air told him that dawn was not far off. The touch of it on his face made him shiver, prompting another chill. Someone said something he didn't understand, and still entangled in the miasma of fever dreams, he thought it must be one of the serpents he'd been talking to earlier, before they started chasing him. A hand touched his forehead, and a large thumb pried up one of his eyelids. An Indian's face floated in his sleep-bleared vision, looking quizzical. He made an irritable noise and jerked his head away, blinking. The Indian said something, questioning, and a familiar voice replied.
Who?
Murray. The name seemed to have been floating by his elbow, and he recalled dimly that Murray himself had accompanied him in his dream, rebuking the serpents in a stern Scots burr. He wasn't speaking English now, though, nor even the peculiar Scots tongue from the Highlands. William forced his head to turn, though his body was still convulsed with chill. A number of Indians were crouched round the fire, squatting to keep their backsides from the dew-wet grass. One, two, three, six of them. Murray was sitting on the log with one of them, engaged in conversation. No, seven. Another man, the one who touched him, leaned over him, peering into his face.
Think you're going to die? The man asked with a faint air of curiosity.
No, William said between clenched teeth. Who the devil are you? The Indian seemed to think this an amusing question and called to his fellows, apparently repeating it. They all laughed, and Murray glanced in his direction, rising as he saw that William was awake.
Kanyen Gahaka,
the man looming over him said and grinned.
Who the devil are you?
My kinsman,
Murray said shortly before William could reply. He nudged the Indian aside and squatted beside William.
Still alive, then?
Evidently.
He scowled up at Murray.
Care to introduce me to your friends?
The first Indian went off into gales of laughter at this and apparently translated it to the two or three others who had come to peer interestedly at him. They thought it funny too. Murray seemed substantially less amused.
"My kinsmen," he said dryly, "some of them. Do you need water?"
"You have a lot of kinsmen, cousin."
"Yes, if you please."
He struggled upright, one-armed, reluctant to leave the clammy comfort of his dew-wet blanket, but obeying an innate urge that told him he wanted to be on his feet. Murray seemed to know these Indians well, but kin or not, there was a certain tenseness to Murray's mouth and shoulders, and it was plain enough that Murray had told them that William was his kinsman, because if he hadn't...
"Kanyen Kehaka,"
that's what the Indian had said when asked who he was. It wasn't his name, William realized suddenly. It was what he was. Murray had used the word yesterday when he'd sent away the two Mingos.
"I'm Kanyen Kehaka," he'd said. "A Mohawk. They're afraid of me."
He'd said it as a simple statement of fact, and William had not chosen to make an issue of it, circumstances being as they were. Seeing a number of what were plainly Mohawk together, he could appreciate the Mingo's prudence. The Mohawk gave off an air of genial ferocity, this overlying a casual confidence entirely proper to men who were prepared to sing, however badly, whilst being emasculated and burnt alive. Murray handed him a canteen, and he drank thirstily, then splashed a little water over his face. Feeling a bit better, he went for a piss, then walked to the fire and squatted between two of the braves, who eyed him with open curiosity. Only the man who had pried his eyelid open seemed to speak English, but the rest nodded to him, reserved but friendly enough. William glanced across the fire and started back, nearly losing his balance. A long, tawny shape lay in the grass beyond the fire, the light gleaming on its flanks.
"It's dead," Murray said dryly, seeing his startlement. The Mohawk all laughed. "Gathered that," he replied just as dryly, though his heart was still pounding from the shock. "Serve it right, if it's the one that took my horse."
Now he came to look, he perceived other shapes beyond the fire. A small deer, a pig, a spotted cat, and two or three egrets, small white mounds in the dark grass. Well, that explained the Mohawk's presence in the swamp. They'd come for the hunting, like everyone else. Dawn was coming. The faint wind stirred the damp hair on his neck and brought him the tang of blood and musk from the animals. Both his mind and his tongue felt thick and slow, but he managed a few words of praise for the success of the hunters. He knew how to be polite. Murray, translating for him, looked surprised, though pleased, to discover that William had manners. William didn't feel well enough to take offence. Conversation became general then, accomplished for the most part in Mohawk. The Indian showed no particular interest in William, though the man beside him handed him a chunk of cold meat in a companionable fashion. He nodded thanks and made himself eat it, though he would as soon have forced down one of his shoe soles. He felt unwell and clammy, and when he had finished the meat, nodded politely to the Indian next to him and went to lie down again, hoping he wouldn't vomit. Seeing this, Murray lifted his chin in William's direction and said something to his friends in Mohawk, ending with a question of some kind. The English speaker, a short, thick-set fellow in a checked wool shirt and buckskin trousers, shrugged in reply, then got up and came to bend over him again.
"Show me this arm," he said,
and without waiting for William to comply, picked up his wrist and pulled up the sleeve of his shirt. William nearly passed out. When the black spots stopped whirling in front of his eyes, he saw that Murray and two more Indians had come to join the first. All of them were looking at his exposed arm in open consternation. He didn't want to look, but risked a glance. His forearm was grotesquely swollen, nearly twice its normal size, and dark reddish streaks ran from under the tightly bandaged poultice down his arm toward the wrist.
The English speaker. What had Murray called him? Glutton, he thought. But why?
Drew his knife and cut the bandage. Only with the removal of its constriction did William realize how uncomfortable the binding had been. He repressed the urge to rub his arm, feeling the pins and needles of returning circulation.
Pins and needles? Bloody hell.
It felt as though his arm were engulfed by a mass of fire ants, all stinging.
Shit,
he said through his teeth. All the Indians knew that word, evidently, for they all laughed, save Glutton and Murray, who were squinting at his arm.
Glutton? He didn't look fat. Why was he called that?
Poked gingerly at the arm, shook his head, and said something to Murray, then pointed off toward the west. Murray rubbed a hand over his face, then shook his head violently in the manner of a man shaking off fatigue or worry. Then he shrugged and asked something of the group at large. Nods and shrugs, and several of the men got up and went into the wood. A number of questions revolved slowly through William's brain, round and bright like the metal globes of his grandfather's orrery in the library of the London house at Jermyn Street.
What are they doing? What's happening? Am I dying? Am I dying like a British soldier? Why did he... British soldier?
His mind caught the tail of that one as it passed, pulling it down to look at more carefully.
British soldier? Who had said that?
The answer spun slowly into view. Murray, when they talked in the night.
What had Murray said?
Is it different for a British soldier, then? You don't want to die as a coward, do you?
Not going to die at all, he muttered.
But his mind ignored him, intent on tracking this small mystery. What had Murray meant by that? Had he been speaking theoretically? Or had he, in fact, recognized William as a British soldier?
Not possible, surely.
And what the devil had he said in reply? The sun was coming up, the dawning light bright enough to hurt his eyes, soft as it was. He squinted, concentrating.
It's not so different, the hoping to die well if you have to, he'd said.
So he'd answers as though he was a British soldier, damn him. At the moment he didn't really care whether he died well or like a dog.
Where was the...
Oh, there. Rollo sniffed at his arm, making a small whining noise in the back of his throat, then nosed at the wound and began to lick it. It felt most peculiar, painful but weirdly soothing, and he made no move to drive the dog away.
What? Oh, yes. He had simply replied, not noticing what Murray had said. But what if Murray did know who or what he was?
A small stab of alarm pierced the muddle of his slowing thoughts. Had Murray been following him before he came into the swamp? Seen him speaking to the man at the wilderness farm near the edge of the swamp, perhaps? And followed, ready to intercept him when the opportunity should offer? But if that were true... What Murray had said about Henry Washington, about Dismal Town, was it a lie? The stocky Indian knelt down beside him, nudging the dog away. William couldn't ask any of the questions clogging his brain.
Why do they call you Glutton? He asked instead, through the haze of hot pain.
The man grinned and pulled open the neck of his shirt to display a mass of wilted scars that covered neck and chest.
Killed one, he said, with my hands. My spirit animal now. You have one?
No.
The Indian looked reproving at this.
You need one. You going to live through this? Pick one. Pick a strong one.
Muzzily obedient, William groped through random images of animals.
Pig. Snake. Deer. Catamount. No. Too rank. Foul-smelling.
Bear, he said,
settling on that with a sense of certainty. Didn't get any stronger than a bear, did it?
Bear,
the Indian repeated, nodding.
Yes, that's good.
He slit William's sleeve with his knife. The fabric would no longer fit easily over the swollen arm. Sunlight washed suddenly over him, glanced silver from the blade of his knife. He looked at William then and laughed.
You got one red beard, bear cub. You know that?
I know that, William said, and shut his eyes against the spears of morning's light. Glutton wanted the catamount's skin, but Murray, alarmed by William's condition, refused to wait for him to skin it. The upshot of the resulting argument was that William found himself occupying a hastily constructed travoy, cheek by jowl with the dead cat, being dragged over rough terrain behind Murray's horse. Their destination, he was given to understand, was a small settlement some 10 miles distant, which boasted a doctor. Glutton and two of the other Mohawk came with them in order to show the way, leaving their other companions to continue hunting. The catamount had been gutted, which William supposed might be better than not. The day was warm and getting hot, but the scent of blood drew masses of flies, which feasted at their leisure as the horse, burdened with the travoy, could not go fast enough to outpace them. The flies hummed and buzzed and shrilled about his ears, setting his nerves on edge, and while most were interested in the cat, enough of them cared to try William for taste, as sufficed to keep his mind off his arm. When the Indians paused for urination and water, they hauled William to his feet, a relief, even wobbly as he was. Murray glanced at his fly-bitten, sunburned features, and, reaching into a skin bag slung at his waist, pulled out a battered tin, which turned out to contain a highly malodorous ointment, with which he anointed William liberally.
"It's no but another 5 or 6 miles," he assured William, who hadn't asked.
"Oh, good," William said, with what vigour he could muster.
"It's not hell after all, then. Only purgatory. What's another 1,000 years?
That made Murray laugh, though Glutton regarded him in puzzlement.
"He'll do,"
Murray said, clapping him on the shoulder.
"Want to walk for a bit?" "God, yes."
His head swam, his feet refused to point forward, and his knees seemed to bend in unwanted directions, but anything was better than another hour of communing with the flies that blanketed the catamount's glazed eyes and drying tongue. Provided with a stout stick cut from an oak sapling, he plodded doggedly behind the horse, alternately drenched with sweat and shaking with clammy chills, but determined to stay upright until, and unless, he actually fell down. The ointment did keep the flies at bay. All the Indians were likewise smeared with it, and when not fighting the shaking, he lapsed into a sort of trance, concerned only with putting one foot before the other. The Indians and Murray kept an eye on him for a time, but then, satisfied that he could remain upright, returned to their own conversations. He couldn't understand the two Mohawk speakers, but Glutton appeared to be catechizing Murray closely concerning the nature of purgatory. Murray was having some difficulty in explaining the concept, apparently owing to the Mohawk having no notion of sin or of a god concerned with the wickedness of man.
"You're lucky you became Cayenne Kahaka," Glutton said at last, shaking his head. "A spirit not satisfied with an evil man being dead, but that wants to torture him after death? And Christians think we're cruel." "Aye, well," Murray replied, "but think. See, a man is a coward and hasna died well. Purgatory gives him a chance to prove his courage after all, no? And once he has proved a proper man, then the bridge is open to him, and he can pass through the clouds of terrible things unhindered to paradise." Glutton said, though he seemed still dubious. "I suppose if a man can stand to be tortured for hundreds of years. But how does he do this, if no body? Do you think a man needs a body to be tortured?"
Murray asked this with a certain dryness, and Glutton grunted in what might be either agreement or amusement, and dropped the subject. They all walked in silence for some time, surrounded by bird calls and the loud buzzing of flies. Preoccupied with the effort of remaining upright, William had fixed his attention on the back of Murray's head as a means of not veering off the trail, and thus noticed when the Scot, who was leading the horse, slowed his pace a little. He thought at first that this was on his account, and was about to protest that he could keep up, for a little while at least, but then saw Murray glance swiftly at the other Mohawk who had drawn ahead, then turn to Glutton and ask something in a voice too low for William to make out the words. Glutton hunched his shoulders in reluctance, then let them fall, resigned.
"Oh, I see," he said. "She's your purgatory, eh?"
Murray made a sound of reluctant amusement.
"Does it matter?
I asked if she's well."
Glutton sighed, shrugging one shoulder.
"Yes. Well, she has a son. A daughter too, I think. Her husband, I..."
Murray's voice had hardened in some fashion.
"You know Tyandanega?"
"I do."
Now Murray sounded curious. William was curious himself in a vague, unfocused sort of way, and waited to hear who Tyandanega might be, and what he had to do with the woman who was, who had been, Murray's paramour. "Oh, no.
I am no longer wed. His wife, then."
William felt a pang of sympathy thinking of Marjorie. He had thought of her only casually, if at all, in the past 4 years. But suddenly, her betrayal seemed tragedy. Images of her swam about him, fractured by a sense of grief. He felt moisture running down his face, didn't know if it was sweat or tears. The thought came to him, slowly as from a great distance, that he must be off his head, but he had no notion what to do about it. The flies weren't biting, but were still buzzing in his ears. He listened to the hum with great concentration, convinced that the flies were trying to tell him something important. He listened with great attention, but could make out only nonsense syllables. Shosha, Nick, Osoni. No, that was a word. He knew that one. White man. It meant white man. Were they talking about him? He pawed clumsily at his ear, brushing at the flies, and caught that word again. Purgatory. For a time he couldn't place the meaning of the word. It hung in front of him, covered with flies. Dimly he perceived the horse's hindquarters gleaming in the sun, the twin lines made in the dust by the... what was it? A thing made of... bed? No. Canvas. He shook his head. It was his bed sack, wrapped about two trailing saplings. Trailing... travoy. That was the word, yes. And the cat. There was a cat there, looking at him with eyes like rough amber, its head turned over its shoulder, open mouth, its fangs showing. Now the cat was talking to him, too.
"You mad? You know that?"
"I know that," he murmured. He didn't catch the cat's reply, growled in a Scottish accent. He leaned closer to hear, felt as though he floated down through air thick as water toward that open mouth. Suddenly all sense of effort ceased. He was no longer moving, but was supported somehow. Couldn't see the cat. Oh, he was lying face down on the ground, grass and dirt beneath his cheek. The cat's voice floated back to him, angry but resigned.
"This purgatory of yours, you think you can get out walking backward?"
Well, no, William thought, feeling peaceful. That made no sense at all. Chapter 38 Plain Speech The young woman snicked the blades of her scissors in thoughtful fashion.
"The Azure?" she asked. "It seems a shame, friend William. Such a striking colour."
"I should think you'd consider it unseemly, Miss Hunter," William said, smiling. "I had always heard that Quakers think bright colours to be worldly."
The only colour in her own dress was a small bronzy-coloured brooch that held her kerchief together. Everything else was shades of cream and butternut, though he thought these suited her. She looked reprovingly at him. "Immodest ornament in dress is hardly the same as grateful acceptance of the gifts God hath given. Do bluebirds pluck out their feathers, or roses fling away their petals?"
"I doubt that roses itch," he said, scratching at his chin.
The notion of his beard as a gift of God was novel, but not sufficiently persuasive as to convince him to go about as a whiskeranto. Beyond its unfortunate colour, it grew with vigour, but sparsely. He looked disapprovingly at the modest square of looking-glass in his hand. He could do nothing about the peeling sunburn that patched his nose and cheeks, or the scabbed scrapes and scratches left by his adventures in the swamp. But the hideous copper curls that sprouted jauntily from his chin and plastered themselves like a disfiguring moss along his jaw, that, at least, could be amended at once.
"If you please."
Her lips twitched, and she knelt down beside his stool, turning his head with a hand beneath his chin so as to take best advantage of the light from the window.
"Well, then," she said,
and laid the scissors cool against his face.
"I'll ask Denny to come and shave thee. I dare say I can cut thy beard without wounding thee, but—"
Her eyes narrowed, and she leaned closer, snipping delicately round the curve of his chin.
"I've not shaved anything more lively than a dead pig myself."
"Baba, baba," he murmured, trying not to move his lips. "Shave a pig, howm."
Her fingers pressed up under his chin, firmly shutting his mouth, but she made the small snorting sound that passed with her for laughter. Snip, snip, snip. The blades tickled pleasantly against his face, and the wiry hairs brushed his hands as they fell into the worn linen towel she'd placed across his lap. He'd had no opportunity to study her face at such close range, and took full advantage of the brief opportunity. Her eyes were almost brown, and not quite green. He wished suddenly to kiss the end of her nose. He shut his eyes instead and breathed. She'd been milking a goat, he could tell.
"I can shave myself," he said, when she lowered the scissors.
She raised her brows and glanced downward at his arm.
"I should be surprised if thee can feed thyself yet, let alone shave."
In all truth, he could barely lift his right arm, and she had been feeding him for the last 2 days. That being so, he thought better of telling her that he was, in fact, left-handed.
"It's healing well," he said instead,
and turned his arm so the light shone upon it. Dr. Hunter had removed the dressing only that morning, expressing gratification at the results. The wound was still red and puckered, the skin around it unpleasantly white and moist. It was, however, undoubtedly healing. The arm was no longer swollen, and the ominous red streaks had disappeared.
"Well," she said consideringly, "it's a fine scar, I think. Well knit. And rather pretty."
"Pretty?" William echoed, looking sceptically at his arm.
He'd heard men now and then describe a scar as pretty, but most commonly they meant one that had healed straight and clean, and did not disfigure the bearer by passing through some significant feature. This one was jagged and sprawling, with a long tail leading toward his wrist. He had, he was told sometime after the fact, narrowly escaped loss of the arm. Dr. Hunter had grasped it and placed his amputation saw just above the wound, only to have the abscess that had formed below it burst in his hand. Seeing this, the doctor had hastily drained the wound, packed it with garlic and comfrey, and prayed, to good effect.
"It looks like an enormous star," Rachel Hunter said approvingly, "one of significance. A great
comet, perhaps, or the Star of Bethlehem, which led the wise men to the manger of Christ.
William turned his arm, considering. He thought it looked rather more like a bursting mortar shell himself, but said merely, in an encouraging manner. He wished to continue the conversation. She seldom lingered when she fed him, having much other work to do, and so lifted his newly shorn chin and gestured at the brooch she wore.
"That's pretty," he said. "Not too worldly."
"No," she said tartly, putting a hand to the brooch.
"It's made of my mother's hair.
She died when I was born."
"Ah, I'm sorry," he said,
and with a moment's hesitation added,
"So did mine."
She stopped then and looked at him, and for a moment he saw a flicker of something in her eyes that was more than the matter-of-fact attention she would give to a cow in calf, or a dog that had eaten something that disagreed with it.
"I'm sorry, too," she said softly,
then turned with decision. "I'll fetch my brother." Her footsteps went down the narrow stair, quick and light. He picked up the ends of the towel and shook it out the window, scattering the ruddy hair clippings to the four winds and good riddance. He might have grown a beard as a rudimentary disguise had it been a decently sober brown. As it was, a full beard of that garish colour would rivet the eye of everyone who saw him. What to do now, he wondered. Surely he would be fit to leave by tomorrow. His clothes were still wearable, if worse for wear. Miss Hunter had patched the tears in his breeches and coat. But he had no horse, no money, save 2 sixpences that had been in his pocket, and had lost the book with the list of his contacts and their messages. He might recall a few of their names, but without the proper code words and signs. He thought quite suddenly of Henry Washington and that hazy, half-remembered conversation with Ian Murray by the fire before they had begun to speak of death songs. Washington, Cartwright, Harrington and Carver. The chanted list returned to him, together with Murray's puzzled reply to his mention of Washington and Dismaltown. He could not think of any reason why Murray should seek to mislead him on the matter. But if he was correct, was Captain Richardson grossly mistaken in his intelligence? That was possible, certainly. Even in as short a time as he had been in the colonies, he had learned just how quickly loyalties could shift with changing news of threat or opportunity. "But," said the small, cold voice of reason, and he felt its chilly touch on his neck, "if Captain Richardson was not mistaken, then he meant to send you to death or imprisonment." The sheer enormity of the idea dried his mouth, and he reached for the cup of herbal tea that Miss Hunter had brought him earlier. It tasted foul, but he scarcely noticed, clutching it as though it might be a talisman against the prospect he imagined. "No," he assured himself, "it wasn't possible. His father knew Richardson. Surely, if the captain were a traitor, what was he thinking?" He gulped the tea, grimacing as he swallowed. "No," he said aloud, "not possible." "Or not likely," he added fairly. "Occam's razor." The thought calmed him a little. He had learned the basic principles of logic at an early age and had found William of Occam a sound guide before. Was it more likely that Captain Richardson was a hidden traitor who had deliberately sent William into danger, or that the captain had been misinformed, or had simply made a mistake? Come to that, what would be the point of it? William was under no delusion concerning his own importance in the scheme of things. Where would be the benefit to Richardson, or anyone else, in destroying a junior officer engaged in minor intelligencing? Well, then. He relaxed a bit, and taking an unwary mouthful of the ghastly tea, choked on it and coughed, spraying tea everywhere. He was still wiping up the residue with his towel when Dr. Hunter came trotting briskly up the stair. Denzel Hunter was perhaps 10 years his sister's senior, somewhere in his late 20s,
small-boned, and cheerful as a cock sparrow. He beamed at the sight of William, plainly so delighted at his patient's recovery that William smiled warmly back.
"Sissy tells me thee requires to shave," the doctor said, setting down the shaving mug and brush he had brought. "Plainly thee must be feeling well enough to contemplate a return to society. For the first thing any man does when free of social constraint is to let his beard grow. Has thee moved thy bowels as yet?"
"No, but I propose to do so almost at once," William assured him.
"I am not, however, of a mind to venture out in public looking like a bandit, not even to the privy. I shouldn't wish to scandalize your neighbours."
Dr. Hunter laughed, and withdrawing a razor from one pocket and his silver-rimmed spectacles from another, set the latter firmly on his nose and picked up the shaving brush.
"Oh, Sissy and I are already a hissing and a byword," he assured William, leaning close to apply the lather. "Seeing banditti emerging from our privy would merely confirm the neighbours in their opinions."
"Really?"
William spoke carefully, twisting his mouth so as to avoid having it inadvertently filled with soap.
"Why?"
He was surprised to hear this. Once regaining his senses, he had asked where he was, and learned that Oak Grove was a small Quaker settlement. He had thought Quakers in general to be most united in their religious sentiments, but then he didn't really know any Quakers. Hunter heaved a deep sigh, and laying down the shaving brush, took up the razor in its stead.
"Oh, politics," he said, in an offhand tone, as of one wishing to dismiss a tiresome but trivial subject. "Tell me, friend Ransom, is there someone to whom I might send to tell them of thy mishap and delivery?"
He paused in the shaving to allow William to reply.
"No, I thank you, sir. I shall tell them myself," William said, smiling. "I am sure I will be able to leave by tomorrow, though I assure you that I will not forget your kindness and hospitality when I reach my friends."
Denzel Hunter's brow furrowed a little, and his mouth compressed as he resumed the shaving, but he made no argument.
"I trust thee will forgive my inquisitiveness," he said after a moment. "But where does thee intend to go from here?"
William hesitated, not sure what to reply. He had, in fact, not decided exactly where to go, given the lamentable state of his finances. The best notion that had occurred to him was that he might head for Mount Josiah, his own plantation. He wasn't positive, but thought he must be within 40 or 50 miles of it. If the hunters might give him a little food, he thought, he could reach it within a few days, a week at most. And once there, he could re-equip himself with clothes, a decent horse, arms and money, and thus resume his journey. It was a tempting prospect. To do that, though, was to reveal his presence in Virginia, and to cause considerable comment, as everyone in the county not only knew him, but knew he was a soldier. To turn up in the neighbourhood dressed as he was.
"There are a few Catholics at Rosemount," Dr. Hunter observed with diffidence, wiping the razor on the much-abused towel.
William glanced at him in surprise.
"Oh?" he said warily.
Why the devil was Hunter telling him about Catholics?
"I beg pardon, friend," the doctor apologized, seeing his reaction. "Thee had mentioned thy friends. I thought..." "You thought I was..."
Puzzlement was succeeded by a jolt of realization, and William slapped a hand in reflex against his chest, naturally finding nothing but the much-worn nightshirt he was wearing.
"Here it is."
The doctor bent swiftly to open the blanket box at the foot of the bed and stood up, the wooden rosary swinging from one hand.
"We had to remove it, of course, when we undressed thee, but Sissy put it safe away to keep for thee."
"We?" William said, seizing on this as a means of delaying inquiry.
"You and Miss Hunter undressed me?" "Well, there was no one else," the doctor said apologetically. "We were obliged to lay thee naked in the creek in hopes of quelling thy fever. Thee does not recall?"
He did, vaguely, but had assumed the memory of overwhelming cold and a sense of drowning to be more remnants of his fever dreams. Miss Hunter's presence had fortunately, or perhaps unfortunately, not formed part of those memories.
"I could not carry thee alone," the doctor was explaining earnestly. "And the neighbours..."
"I did provide a towel for the preservation of thy modesty," he assured William hastily.
"What quarrel do your neighbours have with you?" William inquired curiously, reaching out to take the rosary from Hunter's hand.
"I am not a papist myself," he added offhandedly. "It is a memento, given me by a friend."
"Oh." The doctor rubbed a finger across his lips, plainly disconcerted.
"I see. I had thought..."
"The neighbours?" William asked, and suppressing his embarrassment, hung the rosary once more around his neck. Perhaps the mistake over his religion was the basis of the neighbours' animus.
"Well, I dare say they would have helped to carry thee," Dr. Hunter admitted, "had there been time to go and fetch someone. The matter was urgent, though, and the nearest house is a goodly distance."
This left the question of the neighbour's attitude toward the Hunters unanswered, but it seemed unmannerly to press further. William merely nodded and stood up. The floor tilted abruptly under him and white light flickered at the edge of his vision. He grabbed at the windowsill to keep from falling and came to his senses a moment later, bathed in sweat, with Dr. Hunter's surprisingly strong grip of his arm preventing his tumbling headfirst into the yard below.
"Not quite so fast, friend Ransom," the doctor said gently,
and, hauling him in, turned him back toward the bed.
"Another day, perhaps, before thee stands alone. Thee has more phlegm than is useful to thee, I fear."
Mildly nauseated, William sat on the bed and allowed Dr. Hunter to wipe his face with the towel. Evidently, he had a bit more time in which to decide where to go.
"How long do you think before I can walk a full day?"
Denzel Hunter gave him a considering look.
5 days, perhaps. 4, at the least," he said. "Thee is robust and full-blooded, else I would say a week."
William, feeling puny and pallid, nodded and lay down. The doctor stood frowning at him for a moment, though it didn't seem that the frown was directed at him. It seemed rather an expression of some inner concern.
"How far will thy travels take thee?" the doctor asked, choosing his words with apparent care. "Quite some distance," William replied with equal wariness. "I'm headed toward Canada," he said, suddenly realizing that to say more might imply more than he wished to give away regarding his reasons for travel. True, a man might have business in Canada without necessarily having dealings with the British Army who occupied Quebec. But as the doctor had mentioned politics, best to be politic about the matter. And certainly he would not mention Mount Josiah.
Whatever the Hunters' strained relations with their neighbours, news concerning their visitor might easily spread.
"Canada,"
the doctor repeated, as though to himself. Then his gaze returned to William.
"Yes, that is some considerable distance. Luckily, I have killed a goat this morning. We will have meat. That will help to restore thy strength. I will bleed thee tomorrow to restore some balance to thy humours, and then we shall see. For the moment..."
He smiled and extended a hand.
"Come, I'll see thee safe to the privy."
Chapter 39. A Matter of Conscience. There was a storm coming. William could feel it in the shifting of the air, see it in the racing cloud shadows that scudded across the worn floorboards. The heat and damp oppression of the summer day had lifted, and the restlessness of the air seemed to stir him as well. Though still weak, he could not remain abed, and managed to get up, clinging to the washstand until the initial giddiness left him. Left to himself,
He then passed some time in walking from one side of the room to the other, a distance of 10 feet or so, one hand pressed against the wall for balance. The effort drained and dizzied him, and now and then he was obliged to sit down on the floor, head hung between his knees until the spots ceased to dance before his eyes. It was on one of these occasions, while seated beneath the window, that he heard voices from the yard below. Miss Rachel Hunter's voice, surprised and questioning. A man's reply, low-voiced and husky. A familiar voice. Ian Murray. He shot to his feet and just as quickly subsided back onto the floor, vision black and head swimming. He clenched his fists and panted, trying to will the blood to return to his head.
He will live then.
The voices were distant, half buried in the murmur of the chestnut trees near the house, but he caught that. He struggled up onto his knees and caught hold of the sill, blinking into the cloud-shattered brightness of the day. Murray's tall figure was visible at the edge of the dooryard, gaunt in buckskins, the huge dog at his side. There was no sign of Glutton or the other Indians, but two horses were cropping grass in the lane behind Murray, reins dangling. Rachel Hunter was gesturing to the house, plainly inviting Murray to come in, but he shook his head. He reached into the bag at his waist and withdrew a small package of some sort, which he handed to the girl.
"Hoy!" William shouted,
or tried to shout. He hadn't much breath, and waved his arms. The wind was rising with a shivering rush through the chestnut leaves, but the motion must have caught Murray's eye, for he glanced up, and seeing William in the window, smiled and lifted his own hand in greeting. He made no move to enter the house, though. Instead, he picked up the reins of one horse and put them into Rachel Hunter's hand. Then, with a wave of farewell toward William's window, he swung himself up onto the other horse with an economical grace and rode away. William's hands tightened on the sill, disappointment surging through him at seeing Murray vanish into the trees. Wait, though. Murray had left a horse. Rachel Hunter was leading it around the house, her apron and petticoats aswirl in the rising wind, one hand on her cap to keep it in place. It must be for him, surely. Did Murray mean to come back for him, then? Or was he to follow? Heart thumping in his ears, William pulled on his patched breeches and the new stockings Rachel had knitted for him, and after a short struggle got his water-stiffened boots on over them. The effort left him trembling, but he stubbornly made his way downstairs, lurching, sweating and slipping, but arriving in the kitchen at the bottom in one piece. The back door opened with a blast of wind and light, then slammed abruptly, jerked out of Rachel's hand. She turned, saw him, and yelped in startlement.
"Lord save us! What is he doing down here?"
She was panting with exertion and fright and glared at him, tucking wisps of dark hair back under her cap.
"I didn't mean to startle you," William said in apology. I saw Mr. Murray leaving. I thought I might catch him up.
Did he say where I was to meet him?"
"He did not. Sit, for heaven's sake, before thee falls down."
He didn't want to. The desire to be out, to go, was overwhelming. But his knees were shaking, and if he didn't sit down shortly... Reluctantly, he sat.
"What did he say?" he asked,
and realizing suddenly that he was sitting in a lady's presence, gestured at the other stool. "Sit, please.
Tell me what he said."
Rachel eyed him, but sat, smoothing her wind-blown clothing back into place. The storm was rising, cloud shadows raced across the floor, across her face, and the air seemed to waver, as though the room were underwater.
"He asked after thy health, and when I told him thee was mending, he gave me the horse, saying it was for thee."
He hesitated for an instant, and William pushed.
"He gave you something else, did he not? I saw him give you a package of some kind."
Her lips pressed together for an instant, but she nodded, and reaching into her pocket, handed him a small bundle loosely wrapped in cloth. He was eager to see what the packet contained, but not so eager that he did not notice the marks in the cloth, deep lines where string had once been tied round it, and tied very recently. He glanced up at Rachel Hunter, who looked away, chin high, but with colour rising in her cheeks. He cocked an eyebrow at her, then bent his attention to the packet. Opened, it contained a small sheaf of paper continentals, a worn pouch containing the sum of 1 guinea, 3 shillings, and 2d in coin, a much-folded and refolded, if he was any judge, letter, and another, smaller bundle, this one still tied. Setting this aside and the money, he opened the letter.
"Cousin, I hope to find you in better health than when last seen. If so, I will leave a horse and some funds to assist your travels. If not, I will leave the money to pay either for your medicine or your burial. The other thing is a gift from a friend whom the Indians call Bear Killer. He hopes that you will wear it in good health. I wish you luck in your ventures. Your obedient servant, Ian Murray."
William was baffled by this. Evidently, Murray had business of his own and couldn't, or didn't, wish to stay until William was able to travel. Though somewhat disappointed, he would have liked to talk further with Murray now that his mind was clear again. He could see that it might be better that Murray didn't mean them to travel together. It dawned upon him that his immediate problem was solved. He now had the means to resume his mission, or as much of it as he could. He could at least reach General Howe's headquarters, make a report, and get new instructions. It was remarkably generous of Murray. The horse had looked sound, and the money was more than enough to see him comfortably fed and lodged all the way to New York. He wondered where on earth Murray had got it. By his looks, the man hadn't got a pot to piss in. Though he had a good rifle,